Friends, Romans, countrymen, I'm speaking to you up the back there. If you could all just give me a slight moment of your time, I bring you the latest dispatch from Gaius Julius Caesar's campaign in Gaul. You heard me right, the big guy. As you are all aware, the venerable Caesar, once, twice, three times our dictator, is the governor of Cisalpine Gaul, and we all know how lucky they are for it. Well, one day, when he is nobly governing, he receives a message. The Helvetii are revolting. I'm sure that's news to none of us. These are the words of Caesar, conveyed through Rhiannon Evans and Matt Smith. Gaul is a whole divided into three parts, one of which is inhabited by the Belgae, another by the Aquitani, and a third by people called in their own...
We are going to use the translation from the Loeb Classical Library by H.J. Edwards, which is from 1917. Now, this is because this is available online. You can go to that great website, Lacus Curtius.
Shout out to Bill.
Yes. Hello, Bill. It's also got some of Bill Thayer's notes there that he's added. But of course, he's faithfully put up the translation. As he says there, he's not in a hurry to put up the Latin, because the Latin, you can just go to the Latin library and find it very easily there. Mm-hmm. The Loeb translation is, of course, not the newest translation, but it is universally available. There are newer translations. So the one that I use usually with my students is the one by Carolyn Hammond, which is in Oxford World Classics, which is not expensive.
Yep.
That's from 2008, I think the most recent edition. And there is, of course, a Penguin, which is called The Conquest of Gaul, translated by S.A. Handford. That's from 1951 originally, which is quite old now, but it's been updated by Jane Gardner in 1982. So there are plenty of translations available if you find the Loeb a little bit old for you. But it's actually fine.
Yeah,
you know, considering it's a century old, it certainly does the job.
So just out of curiosity, do you know how many editions of this book you have in various forms?
Oh. Well, I've brought along today my Oxford Classical text.
Yeah.
Obviously inherited because it has somebody else's name in it. And it's from 1968.
Yeah.
It's older than me.
I've got a purple penguin edition kind of thing, which I think you might have there.
Yeah, that's the Handford one. I have another version of this as well. I have the Jane Gardner update, but this is pre the update because, as you say, it's one of those stately looking purple ones.
Yes, imperial looking purple ones.
Yeah, it is. Lovely. I have a great Latin version by Thomas Rice Holmes. 1900, I think it is, which has just incredible notes and really hasn't been superseded in terms of a commentary in English. And then I have individual books. If anyone's interested in either the history or studying the Latin, then there are little Bristol Classical text blue books of each book. I think every single book is covered by that. And they're often used as school texts, but they're very useful for background. Yeah, I could go on.
All right. So where shall we start with Caesar's Gallic War?
Caesar's work is divided into eight books. He only wrote seven of them. The eighth book was added by his general, Aulus Hirtius. But we do talk about there being eight books. And that's the first number we reference when we're referencing Caesar's Gallic War. So 152.
Yep.
Is book one, chapter 52, because we divide each book into chapters. They're quite short chapters. If anyone's scared, a chapter sounds long, but we're talking maybe half a page or less. And in some editions you might, or in some referencing, you might see a further number because the chapters are further subdivided into sections. But the Loeb that we're using doesn't do that, and we're not going to worry about quite that much detail.
Okay.
So generally book and chapter number is what we'll use.
So book one?
Yep. Book one, chapter one.
Line one. Off you go, the famous beginning.
It's a very famous beginning. In Latin, it is Gallia est omnis divisa in partes tres, which means all of Gaul is divided into three parts, which it isn't really, but Caesar divided it into three parts. It's a very famous beginning because it used to be the case that when Latin was taught in a lot of schools, knowing that half sentence was proof that you'd learned Latin.
Oh, great.
So it was like a secret code. If you read P.G. Woodhouse, the Worcester books, Jeeves and Worcester.
Yeah, yeah.
Then
yeah.
He'll sort of say phrases like that occasionally.
Yeah, he does, doesn't he? I guess that shows you about the intelligence and knowing strings of Latin. Maybe.
Well, it shows you a certain kind of background, but yes, it doesn't help Bertie, does it?
No.
So he's already dividing up this Gaul. The first word is Gaul, Gallia. Mm. That's really important. Right, the first word is not Caesar or the Romans or the army or anything like that. It's Gaul itself. And the whole chapter is just about the shape of Gaul and how it's divided up.
All right, so that's good. It gives you a bit of a geography lesson before wading into it all.
Gives you orientation. And yeah. He tells us that these three regions are Aquitania, Gallia, the central regions really called, and Belgica.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't actually say they're called that. He says they're inhabited by the Aquitanians, the Galli, and the Belgici. It's very confusing because, of course, the whole thing is called Gallia, but apparently the central part of it is also called Gallia.
Okay.
Although he then says in their own language, it's inhabited by the Celti, which is not true. That's actually the Greek word for them. He tells us about the borders, what divides them up, and it's the rivers that actually divide up the regions, and they're bounded by rivers and mountains.
Yeah.
So geographical separation. And he says that each of the regions has its own language and its own particular cultural values and rituals. We don't really hear about that ever again, I have to say, throughout the work, and we don't get that much evidence that they do behave differently, except the Belgae are really tough. They're the furthest away, they're the furthest north, and he tells us in that first chapter, that's the reason they're tough. The reason they're tough is they're a long way away from us. We've got the kind of culture and humanity and luxury, is what he implies, that makes you soft.
Yeah.
That means you can just relax. They have to go out and fight every day. Not only do they have to fight for their food, but they're also right on the borders of the Germani, of the Germans, and they've got to fight them all the time. So that keeps them tough. Clearly this, actually not very grudging respect for them.
Yeah.
He does respect the tough Belgae. They're going to be some of his toughest opponents.
So does it give an indication as well of his contemporary divisions of Gaul?
It's what he will divide Gaul into. So, into these three provinces.
Okay.
So it's as if he's already been there. It's actually an argument for the work having been published all at once, I guess, although that's not the general consensus these days. The scholarly view is that he sent home each book each year. It's probably quite artificial. There isn't perhaps a little bit of evidence that the Aquitani, who are the ones who border what we think of as Spain,
yep.
that they might have been a bit culturally different. But in general, Caesar's, his claims that there is this cultural difference aren't really borne out by what we know. For example, he claims there's a big difference between the Galli, the Gauls, on the western side of the Rhine and the Germani on the other side. And really, that seems to be one kind of Celtic civilization.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
there isn't this vast difference between them.
If he's that inaccurate, that's an argument for this being published a book at a time, because where is he going to get this information from?
Well, I don't know if it is necessarily an argument for that. I mean, it's true that he would have got more information as he's there.
Mm.
But it's not like the Romans have had no contact with the Gauls
okay.
yeah. previous to this. And I think it actually fits his remit to have it already subdivided. For one thing, a Roman reading that line would think he was talking about something completely different until he explains it. And this is why he goes into such detail of explaining the three regions of Gaul. Because for the Romans, northern Italy, Cisalpine Gaul, Gaul this side of the Alps, so places like Verona, they're in Gaul.
Yeah.
It's a very civilized Gaul, but nevertheless. The other Gaul would be the province, the Provincia, which is now Provence, which is one of the oldest Roman provinces in southern France, we think of it. And then there's Gaul beyond that. So they call the province, they often call it Gallia Togata, Gaul that wears the toga.
Yeah.
It's been Romanized. And then the other side of the province, all of that vast expanse of France and Belgium, they call Gallia Comata, which means hairy Gaul.
Hairy Gaul.
They don't cut their hair short and they're all a bit...
And the big moustaches.
Yeah. They're all a bit savage and hairy over there. A bit hairy and dirty is the implication.
That was my token asterisk, a reference for the episode.
Okay, but it's not what Caesar's talking about. He's talking about three future provinces. He's looking to the future rather than what they've already got.
Mm.
Now, I think we talked last time about how Caesar's not meant to be in these three new places.
No,
he's meant to be back in his province. Mm. So this is probably quite telling that he's describing something outside of his remit. As I say, he concentrates on the people who are there and who's tougher than the others, which is not surprising because it's a war narrative. So this is going to be important, who's the tougher enemy. And another thing to bear in mind is that even though he divides them into three subgroups, really they're going to be much more subdivided during this work, because he will talk about individual peoples, sometimes described as tribes.
Yeah.
He's often fighting just one of them, or maybe a collection of two or three.
Mm.
These are people who aren't united. It's really important to remember that. They're very rarely united even against Rome. They're already tensions between each other.
Sure, yeah.
So after he describes Gaul, what it is, he needs a reason to get himself into there. And so the next thing he describes is what's going on with the Helvetii.
Mm. So it's at this point we meet our first player.
Yeah.
And the Helvetii, where's that?
The Helvetii, they're in a little corner of ancient Gaul, which kind of stretches out to the east.
Is this Switzerland?
Yeah, it's modern Switzerland.
Helvetica.
Exactly.
Ah.
In fact, the Swiss describe themselves as, on their coins and stamps, is the Confoederatio Helvetica, because that's Latin.
Mm.
And it avoids using French, German, or Italian, I think is the main reason.
Sure.
But they're harking back to this particular Gallic people.
Yep.
And the Helvetii will be the first Gallic people that Caesar comes into conflict with. But when he's describing them in chapter 2 of book 1, he tells us what's been happening. He goes back in time. He's starting in 59 BCE. That's when he becomes governor.
Mm.
But he says 2 years previous to that, he describes it as in the consulship of Marcus Messala and Marcus Piso, but we know that's 61 BCE, that there were certain events going on. And these are events that remind us that all is not settled in Gaul. There are populations moving around.
Mm.
And one of the populations moving around are the people across the Rhine who Caesar universally calls the Germani. And he might be the first person to do that. He might have invented the Germans in a way. They're moving over. There seem to be various things going on there. Sometimes the Germani seem to be invited in to fight in local conflicts. Sometimes they just seem to pour in anyway, that they want more land. And according to Caesar, the land on the Gallic side is more fertile and desirable. The Helvetii are also, if you look at a map of this time, they're kind of caught in a little corner. And Caesar describes this. They're surrounded by the Jura Mountains, the Rhine, and they're sort of stuck in this little pocket, which Caesar says isn't really big enough for their population. So they want to break out anyway. And they've got these pressures from the Germani.
Mm.
So this is a bit of a problem. And all this means that a man called Orgetorix, which is a great Gallic name that I know you'll appreciate, really starts up a conspiracy. Now, he's a noble among his peoples, but he starts doing this secretly rather than openly. That's why it's a conspiracy, a conjuratio, a deep and shadowy thing in Latin, a conjuratio.
Mm.
And he finds it very easy to persuade some of the Helvetii that they need to leave Helvetia, they need to move out. He needs to take over for this to happen. In this conspiracy, we're reminded that the Gauls aren't really united. They have local kinds of kingship, and Orgetorix wants kind of overlordship.
Yeah.
Caesar actually uses very loaded language. He says Orgetorix has the desire for a kingdom. The word for kingdom is regnum, which implies he wants to be a rex, he wants to be a king, which is a bad thing to the Romans. They're still in the Republic. They don't agree with kings.
Okay, yeah.
And he has cupiditas, desire, which also means greed, ambition. He's going to do anything to get this. So Orgetorix is kind of a shady character in Caesar's narrative.
Is this Caesar's effort to build up a villain? In some way, give them a bit of a backstory, justify why Caesar needed to go there and sort this out.
Although you do wonder whether it wouldn't have worked better for Caesar if Orgetorix had been able to hang around, because Orgetorix isn't going to last long in our narrative, I'm sorry to say.
Okay.
Bit of a spoiler.
Yeah.
A couple more chapters and he'll be gone. The thing about Orgetorix is I find him quite an ironic character as he's displayed in Caesar, because he's somebody who can play on the circumstances. There's kind of this dissatisfaction amongst the Helvetii. There's this pressure on, this land pressure on them. So he finds it very easy. Caesar keeps using this word per facile, which means extremely easy to persuade them that they need to leave, that they need to break out. He actually says they could not but consider the territory they occupied to an extent of 240 miles long and 180 broad was all too narrow for their population and for the renown of their courage in war. This is at the end of chapter 2.
Bit flattering.
This is meant to be Orgetorix's words.
Yeah.
All right, so he's kind of flattering his own people. Mm. We're famous for war. Mm-hmm. Remember, they're actually by the Rhine, so they're near to the Germans as well. So they're not actually Belgic peoples, but nevertheless, they're the toughest of the Gauls. And so he finds it easy to persuade them, and the Helvetii that he talks to get behind him and decide that they are going to leave. And it's like what they do is quite dramatic, as told in chapter 3. They get a lot of supplies together. This is why it all takes a couple of years to make this plan. And they decide, actually, that it's going to take them 2 years in chapter 3. They say they need 2 years to get supplies and then they're going to leave. So they need to breed the cattle and grow the crops, get them all on carts, presumably. And in the third year, they'll leave. Orgetorix is planning more than just leaving Helvetia, though. His conspiracy really is to take over all of Gaul. By saying to the Helvetii, you know you're the most powerful in Gaul, what he's working towards is total domination.
Mm.
And Caesar claims to know this, that this is part of his plan. And again, it's very easy, it's per facile in chapter 3 for Orgetorix to persuade the Helvetii of this.
It's not very king-like to need to work this way, though.
It's a bit underhand, yeah. It's clear that Orgetorix, while his psychology is being explored, I suppose, is I don't think he's meant to be presented to us as a positive character at all. What I find ironic about it is that if you were to look at Caesar, you could attribute some of these characteristics to him. This might be slightly getting outside the remit of looking at the Gallic War, but he's somebody who, you know, takes hold of a particular situation and snatches the popular support in Rome.
Mm.
You could say Orgetorix is sort of doing something similar. Now, as I said, Orgetorix isn't going to last very long. He started this conspiracy. Apparently, he's swayed the emotions of the other Helvetians. He's got them behind him. But it's clearly not all the Helvetii. And in chapter 4, it's going to be all over for Orgetorix. And his doom is pretty ignominious. Really not noble at all and extremely chaotic. His whole plan starts to unravel because informers tell the other Helvetii. What this means is they take Orgetorix captive and they make him stand trial, actually tied up. So our text says they compelled Orgetorix to take his trial in bonds.
Yeah.
Slightly old-fashioned translation there, but yeah, bound up. If he's found guilty, he's going to be burnt alive. When his trial happens, it's engineered so that Orgetorix's followers, they come together in their huge numbers and they basically crowd the trial out and allow for such chaos that Orgetorix escapes somehow. And Caesar's not very clear on exactly how this happens, but he does say that up to 10,000 men appear there. Orgetorix's men.
That's a lot.
Seems like a huge number in a way that it would be difficult for Caesar to be sure about.
That's enough men to conquer Gaul.
Well, we'll come to that. The state then says, we're going to get him back. Mm. So it's kind of all on for an armed struggle. But at this point, Orgetorix dies.
Just dies?
Well, the end of that chapter says, not without suspicion, as the Helvetii think, of suicide.
Okay.
And again, this is quite vague, actually. Does that mean that it was clear to Orgetorix that he was going to be captured? Was there some kind of plot from within that he was trying to escape from? Or was he actually murdered?
Mm.
I think it's probably the question we're meant to ask. In a way, though, it doesn't matter because right after this, Caesar tells us that the Helvetii decide, and presumably it's only that portion of the Helvetii that wanted to do this in the first place, maybe the 10,000 men, they decide to do what Orgetorix wanted anyway.
Okay.
They're going to up and leave. This is what becomes important. They're going to march forth from their borders and they're going to have to get out. And one of the ways, as we'll see, that they're going to have to get out of Helvetia could be through the province.
Okay.
So that will bring Caesar into this fray.
Right. So this is Caesar building up an enemy, building up a justification. This is the backstory for why
absolutely
Roman rule was needed.
It sort of seemed a bit random until that point.
Yeah.
But in chapter 6, it will become apparent that the geography is really important because there are only two ways out of Helvetia. One of them is this really dangerous mountain pass. The other one is through the province. And they're going to ask for permission to come through the province. They continue with their planning. And they really show their commitment to it by burning down all of their towns, villages, Caesar calls them. They set fire to their strongholds, Caesar says in chapter 5, in number about 12, and their villages in number about 400, and the rest of their private buildings. And they burn up all the corn they can't take with them, which seems crazy. But he gives the rationale and he says it's so they won't be tempted to go back.
Yeah, it shows a bit of resolve and how much of a dangerous enemy that you're going to come up against, that you're coming up against an enemy with no other option to go forward.
Exactly, and that they really mean this, that this is not just, let's give this chance our arm here, we can always go back home if it doesn't work out.
Yes.
There is no home to go back to.
Yeah.
As you say, I think it is about building up a certain character of the Gauls. These are particularly tough Gauls, as he's already told us, but that certainly in this case, they're a challenging enemy potentially. So when Caesar, and I know this is a bit of a spoiler, when Caesar overcomes them, they are an enemy worth overcoming.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Look, that makes sense to write that in a propaganda document. It really does. Okay, so you were saying earlier that chapter 6, geography.
Yeah, so they go off and they persuade some other peoples to come along with them, so there's kind of a bigger crowd. But then we do get back to the geography. Caesar loves his geography in this early part of the work in particular. And it really determines what's going on with the action because, as he tells us, there were two routes and no more by which they could leave their homeland. One lay through the territory of the Sequani, so this is another Gallic people nearby. This is the mountain pass because it's between the Jura Mountains and the River Rhone, which apparently is known now as the Pas de l'Écluse. But the fact that it's a pass means that it's going to be difficult for a whole people to go along there. They're not all warriors. You know, it's families as well.
And you leave yourself open to ambushes in passes anyway. I've seen enough Westerns to know how that works.
Well, Caesar describes another danger in narrow route and difficult where carts could scarce be drawn up in single file. All right. So they're likely to fall off, in other words. And it's a very, very high mountain. It's a bit of the Alps, basically.
So option two.
Yeah. Oh, and actually, he's got your point. A very few men might easily check them. So he says the other route through, as he calls it, the Roman province, which is the easy route.
Yeah, but if a tribe comes asking to pass through a Roman province en masse, what's going to happen there?
They want to go through the territory in the province of a group called the Allobroge. And Caesar's got this little kind of aside in chapter 6. He says the Allobroge, who had lately been brought to peace. And what he's referring to there is an incident whereby the Allobroge, who remember are part of the province, so they've been colonized by Romans. They've been brought in fairly early into the Roman Empire. When he says they'd lately been brought to peace, what he's referring to is a rebellion which had been put down in 61 BCE. So when the Helvetii had started their planning. The Latin is pacati, pacified, but really it means subdued. They've been put into line. It's quite a violent word. Pacified, it doesn't really cover it.
So it's so recent in memory at this point that you wouldn't want a disruptive force like the Helvetii just walking through that area, would you?
Yes, you wouldn't, because they might stir up another rebellion. But from the Helvetian side, at least as described by Caesar, he says the Helvetii think they can work with this because there's still a bit of Allobroge resentment. So maybe they'll let them through. Maybe they'll help them out. That's the idea. It's kind of interesting because it shows a set of Gauls sort of trying to make use of internal conflict within this Romanized part of Gaul, and that they're aware of what's going on in the Roman world, or at least their local part of the Roman world. this is also the easy way for them to go. And the end of that chapter is very much, this is their schedule. He actually gives the day. Having therefore provided all things for their departure, they named a day by which all should assemble upon the banks of the Rhone. The day was the 28th of March in the consulship of Lucius Piso and Aulus Gabinius.
Mm.
And that means that we have moved into 59 BCE. So this is where our action proper starts. Now, this concentration on geography has led commentators to take a look at the geography. And according to the great Thomas Rice Holmes, who wrote the English language commentary on this in 1900, there were other passes available.
Okay.
So this is a bit of a convenient brushing over the facts by Julius Caesar. Other passes suggest still going through the mountains. So it's still the case that the easiest way to go through the province. But Holmes is writing a commentary. He doesn't go into the implications of that. But the implications are that Caesar doesn't want to go into detail because he wants to make the Helvetii look like a danger to the Romans. That they might come into Roman territory.
Yeah.
This might be a problem for him. So he needs to deal with them. Because remember, he needs a reason for attacking a people that he doesn't really have a remit to go attack.
When your main audience is, quotation fingers, far away in Rome, you can be vague about geography as well and Absolutely. Get away with it.
While looking like you're being very careful about the geography at the same time.
It's quite handy that Caesar is as precise as he is about dates in that time, because that really helps out with timelines.
Yeah. No, Caesar's often very precise about days, down to the day itself.
Mm.
And of course, with each book being a year and the campaigning season, as it's euphemistically called, but basically when you could fight, being quite limited, especially in the frozen north, as the Romans regard Gaul, there's a limited period that this is happening in. And so he's quite precise within that most of the time. If he's not precise, there's probably a reason for it.
Yeah.
And here it is important because he will go on to give the Helvetii an ultimatum and to say, well, I'll give you a decision about whether you can come through the province in a couple of weeks.
Mm.
And that just means they've got to sit there waiting for Caesar's decision. So command of the dates puts him in charge of the situation.
Yeah.
So it is quite important that he's precise about it.
So as far as the start to his first book and the start of the Gallic invasion, it's giving a backstory. It's giving his first main opponent an incentive and explaining why they're a threat, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's showing us that they're dangerous, that even when they're not coming to fight Rome exactly, they're starting to impinge onto Roman territory.
Mm.
Remember, Caesar had been given that province specifically. He'd wanted it. It wasn't in the original offer of the Senate. But you can perhaps read between the lines that Caesar saw that could be a place where there would be some kind of tension and conflict, and somebody strong needed to deal with it from the Roman point of view. And if he hadn't had the province, he really would have had no reason to go beyond into Gaul and to conquer. Mm. So he's clearly got that in mind when he asks for it and gets the people to ask for it on his behalf.
I think it's very effective, though. You've got a people who, there's quite a large amount of people, they've got no other way to go, and they've got nothing to go back to. They've got nothing to lose, so they're a threat.
Yeah, they are. And they prove to be a really formidable opponent in these first 30 chapters of this book. But they're almost a sort of starter for the real main opponent in the rest of the book, who are going to be the Germani under the terrifying Ariovistus. So in the first book, he gets to lay out one really strong, determined Gallic enemy and then the even more scary Germanic enemy beyond that. And of course, you can't really say Caesar manufactures this, but he certainly curates what happens to make it appear that he needs to be there. He needs to be there and he needs to be on campaign. And by the end of the first book, arguably, but certainly by the end of the second book, he's really created a strong reason for being in Gaul. And in that way, you can see the rationale, but it's perhaps a little bit surprising that in the first six chapters of this book that we've discussed, Caesar has not appeared at all.
Mm.
His name hasn't come up. He hasn't used the first person. It's as if he doesn't exist. It's all describing things that have happened at a distance. But the reason for that is he mustn't appear to be somebody who's just desperate to get in there. He needs to describe the circumstances that make it necessary for him to be there.
Having therefore provided all things for their departure, they named a day by which all should assemble upon the bank of the Rhone. The day was the 28th of March,
in the consulship of Lucius Piso and Aulus Gabinius. All right, that's all that I've got for today. No, you'll just have to come back tomorrow. Ave, ave.